You need the sticker to drive and have to take a vehicle emissions test to get the sticker. In Fairbanks, not everybody likes the idea, and the borough would like to give it up, get the state to take over. Assemblymember Hank Bartos says constituents see the IM program as an unfunded mandate, where the state and the feds set the rules but leave the borough to do the work and pay the bill.
I don't think it's whether the program is going to go back to the state. I just think it's when. Is it going to be July or December?
The mayor's budget zeroes out the IM program in 1997, but the Assembly Finance Committee has called for dropping it earlier, as of July 1. Either way, Bartos says the borough will save money but lose some control. Among other things, the state will decide at what age cars must be tested.
Instead of going no earlier than the 75 model year, they're going to go back to the 67 model year and make all vehicles retested. The cost to the program, as far as the IM certificate and the test go, may increase.
Even though the state says it doesn't want the vehicle emissions testing program, Borough Assembly Presiding Officer Cheryl Kilgore says it could take it over at this point.
The state in the last several years has promulgated a number of regulations that frankly enable it to administer the program and have made it very restrictive for us on the local level to provide much in the way of flexibility to our citizens.
Kilgore agrees that what flexibility the borough has now would probably slip away with IM under state management. There's much more on the budget, of course, funding for schools, transportation, child care assistance, and all the other programs and departments funded by the borough. The Assembly takes testimony on every aspect of the budget beginning tonight from 6:30 to midnight in borough chambers. They'll listen as long as people come to talk, with hearing opportunities next Thursday and the following Thursday as well, if the public wants them. Once the public has had its say, the Assembly deliberations begin. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Particularly realizing that this is May, and if we were to eliminate it, it would be effective July 1st, and what would all those folks that rely on the program do in the interim? And in fact, the borough does an excellent job of administering this program and providing a great deal of service at a very, very low cost to the borough.
Maybe the average American is paid up. Average, of course, means some folks don't pay any, and others will still be paying in August. For the rest of us, we've really just dealt with the part of the tax iceberg that sticks up the highest. Withholding, Medicare, Social Security, and property taxes are all out of the way. But sales taxes will be ringing up for a lot of people, and as the famous Ginzu knife ad says, there's still more.
Taxes on cigarettes, taxes on gasoline, taxes on liquor. When you travel, quite a few cities have an entrance tax or an exit tax. There's a number of locations where the hotel tax is greater. As a tourist, you're picking up tax there.
Paul Robinson is a Fairbanks CPA. It's his business to help taxpayers stay honest without walking around in a barrel. He says taxes we don't think about are still coming out of the household budget.
Corporations in our society are taxed, and they have to make a profit, and so really what they do is they more or less pass on that tax to us.
And if that's not irritating enough, he says meditate on some of the taxes you just got done with.
If you stop and think of it, your Social Security tax that you pay has been taxed. So you paid tax on the Social Security that is then taken away from you, too. So it's sort of a tax on a tax.
What to do? He says the best advice is to earn the most you can and accept the fact that you'll just be giving some of it up. In the meantime, Robinson suggests, take your employer up on that 401k or other tax-sheltered benefit. If you're inclined, a small business or a rental will help with taxes, but don't get into them unless you've got time and energy. Robinson says there's no point in losing money just to get a tax break. Finally, the tax man suggests people get some help. As complicated as the tax law is, it's good to have someone on your side. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. Oh, happy Tax Freedom Day.
And obviously pleased, Borough Mayor Jim Sampson stood among school bond supporters Tuesday night. Sampson had reason to smile. The majority of voters accepted his $64 million package that renovates existing schools and builds a new middle school for Fairbanks. Sampson acknowledges winning that voter approval wasn't easy.
It's been a real tough campaign. It got real emotional on both sides. Been pretty, vicious at times, a little nasty, but these are real tough, important issues, and I'm pleased. This was our last opportunity here to access the state reimbursement plan, and so we're ready to put a program together to improve the quality of these schools.
Sampson says time was running out for the borough to take advantage of a state offer that pays 70% of school construction costs. Fairbanks voters rejected two earlier bond issues, and both sides spent thousands of dollars trying to sway voters this go-round. Documents with the Alaska Public Offices Commission say the vote yes supporters attracted roughly $20,000 to their coffers, while the opposing Interior Taxpayers Association garnered nearly as much. ITA spokesperson Donna Gilbert says last-minute money from unions decided the issue.
It's very hard to go against every union in this town and the organization that they were able to pull together. You know, with the union money, the unions doing their signs, the people that they were able to canvass neighborhoods with and things like that, you know, and you're a small group. I will have to tell you that I'm surprised we did as well as we did.
Gilbert fears the state's offer to pay the lion's share of construction costs could fold, leaving borough property owners with a whopping debt. Further, she says, building on leased land will also cost millions. But 53% of those voting Tuesday accepted that risk. Over 25% of registered voters turned out, with some 16,000 votes cast. There are roughly 2,000 question ballots and some 600 absentee ballots still to count. Borough clerks say they'll tabulate those by Friday. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
When Raymond Stickman got the phone call from the Ice Classic people on Sunday, he was so excited he jumped in his truck and headed downtown, yelling the news out his window. Stickman was born and raised on the Lower Yukon River, and locals are glad one of their own has won. Stickman had to leave town early Monday, but Galena resident Bob Summer, who won last year, says he's hoping the trend of Galena winners will continue.
I very much hope that I have started a tradition, and I have now passed the torch to Raymond. I'm very extremely pleased that someone in town won it, and I'm looking forward to whoever the winner is in Galena next year.
Summer received a check worth almost $20,000 last June. He had been playing 20 to 30 of the same minute guesses for the past 13 years. But that didn't stop him from trying again this year with a new number, though he's keeping it a secret. 12 ticket holders will split this year's jackpot worth $300,000, says Classic manager Charles Klein. That leaves about $70,000 for the nonprofit organization after expenses. Each year, the Ice Classic directors decide what to do with the money. Last year, the board purchased a rescue sled for the Nenana EMS and restored the historic tugboat now located next to the visitor center. The Ice Classic employs over 100 Nenana residents for a couple of weeks each spring. Klein says the hardest part of the job is deciphering the handwritten guesses. Officials rejected 242 of the 287,000 tickets sold this year. In Galena, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Before freezers and electricity arrived in the bush, spring bird hunting provided the first fresh meat after a long winter of dried fish. Pooslea resident Catherine Atla says that geese are traditionally important to Koyukuk River Athabascans in the spring.
That we used it when there was no moose, so there's hardly any meat, except a lot of rabbits and things, and we just got to have that pot of soup, and that's the traditional delicacy for us.
But biologists don't recommend spring waterfowl hunting because each nesting female killed in the spring could mean three young birds won't be joining the flock that fall. Declining goose and eider populations prompted the Fish and Wildlife Service to implement a closed season enforcement policy in 1987. Galena Refuge Manager Tom Ely says the policy focuses enforcement during the spring on areas and species where population levels are low. Biologists are concerned about spectacled and Steller's eiders, emperor geese, cackling Canada geese, black brant, and Pacific white-fronted geese. Since most of these nest along the coast of western Alaska, hunters in the interior are not a threat to them. Enforcement emphasis in the interior is on the prevention of waste and the use of aircraft for waterfowl hunting. In the Galena area, Fish and Wildlife personnel monitor hunters closely, but their policy does allow reasonable harvest for subsistence. Some spring hunting may eventually be legal if the U.S. Senate ratifies an amendment to the Migratory Bird Treaty with Canada. Native elders in central and northwest Alaska agree that waterfowl, especially geese, are less abundant than they were 20 to 50 years ago. Last September, John Honey of Ruby described what it was like when ducks and geese were more abundant.
In the early days, when I was a kid, about 10 years old, there was all kinds of geese. There were so many geese that come in through here that there was so unbelievable how many geese and ducks there was at that time.
Biologists say many factors contribute to the drop in waterfowl numbers. The loss of wetlands in the lower 48, droughts in the prairies, and hunting all affect waterfowl populations. Lead poisoning, caused when birds eat lead shot, also contributes to the lower population of waterfowl. In 1991, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service mandated the use of steel shot for waterfowl hunters in an attempt to reduce the poisoning. Some rural subsistence hunters say they know about the waterfowl population problems and have reduced their harvest in spring to help the birds repopulate. These hunters no longer rely on birds for survival, but take a few birds each spring for old time's sake. Sidney Huntington of Galena says he has stopped hunting geese altogether.
I'm saying that I'm doing my share to try to bring them back, and I think a lot of us should. Some people say, well, hell, I'll kill them before somebody else kills them. Well, I don't think that's a good reason to kill them. And I don't blame anybody for going out there and harvesting a bird when they need it to get some good fresh soup that brings back good memories to stuff long ago and stuff like that. And but to go out there and say we want a freezer full of ducks, no, me, I'd rather have a freezer full of fish. I know there's lots of them.
Biologists hope that with the increase in public awareness, the decline of North American waterfowl populations can be reversed. In Galena, I'm Mike Spindler.
However, now with Pete Kelly and the governor changing the law to allow discrimination, the constitutional issue now becomes important. So we have asked the Supreme Court to basically to argue it to them.
Finally, on Sunday, when the when a slab of ice came down and went underneath the ice and then came up, popped back up, it broke the tripod loose and sent it downstream just a short distance, but just far enough to trip the siren and the clock. And then it just rested there for about 2 hours until another big chunk of ice came down and took it downstream.
It doesn't take long to peg Andy Jack for a leader. Just a handshake will do. But if that's not enough, take a look at her schedule. For the next year as Miss Indian World, she expects to be out of town every other weekend, traveling some 75,000 miles. It's a demanding job, and Jack acknowledges the responsibility that comes with the title. She'll be a role model for thousands of young people, but at the same time, she wants people to know she's just like them.
A lot of people call me a celebrity or, you know, give me this these titles, and sure, you know, I'm honored and I want to live up to my expectations and up to everyone else's. I want to display myself in a very positive light, but, you know, I'm also a very ordinary person.
In the days when she's not serving in her official capacity, Jack's studying education at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This summer, she'll be guiding tourists with the Fairbanks Riverboat Company. Jack won the title during the Gathering of Nations powwow in Albuquerque. Her schedule's already filling, and so far includes visits to the Grand Ole Opry, the Today Show, and several powwows. In Fairbanks, Alaska, I'm John McWhorter.
Anchorage police say more and more street gang members are taking lives and engaging in drive-by shootings in Alaska's largest city. Sergeant Steve Warner says the department's chalked up at least 4 gang murders this last year.
We can't always say conclusively that if there was a someone's house or car got shot up that this was gang activity. However, we have had some shootings very recently that we can say are gang related. We've also had several homicides over the past year that were most definitely gang related homicides.
Warner says police aim to keep Anchorage from becoming as riddled with gang crime as lower 48 cities. And its sponsors say Senate Bill 194 means to help law enforcement in that fight. While the legislation hands out stiffer penalties for gang activity, it also stops suspected gang members from claiming self-defense when a shootout takes the life of an innocent bystander. And it allows authorities to seize cars, weapons, cash, and other valuables from gang crime activities. These last two provisions, however, have raised constitutional questions in some legal minds. The bill's sponsors say they've done their homework, but John Salemi, who directs the state's Public Defender Agency, isn't as sure.
The bill has undergone significant modifications to eliminate some of the obvious constitutional infirmities that were part of the original version. I still think that the bill will undergo constitutional scrutiny. There's a certain mushiness to some of the language, which I think may make it difficult for it to stand up to constitutional challenge.
Salemi didn't specify the mushy language, but Professor Carolyn Holmes thinks she can spot it. Holmes teaches justice at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and specializes in gang crime. She agrees with Salemi the bill will be challenged in court based on what she's seen. She thinks the bill's troubles begin when it defines gang.
A group of 3 or more persons who have a common name or identifying sign, symbol, tattoo, or other physical marking, style, address. Well, okay, what if they don't have those things? What if you just have a group of 3 or more persons who go out to do something? Does that mean they're not a gang? And so they're not going to get the accelerated penalties that a gang would just because they have a name or a sign or other kinds of clothes?
Furthermore, asks Holmes, is it a gang-related crime if only one gang member robs or shoots someone? And how are we going to pay for the bill, she asks.
For instance, is there going to be some sort of a gang activity unit installed within either the state or the local level police departments, for instance? And if they are, what are we going to do with these juveniles? I'm assuming we're talking about juveniles in most of these cases, when they hit the system. I don't see any funding for anything as far as corrections. I don't see anything as far as policing. I don't see any funding on how they're going to address any of these issues.
Sponsors of the bill claim their definition of gang has passed court challenges in the lower 48, and the legislation closes loopholes, they say, that have allowed gang members back out on the street. Senate Bill 194 incorporates provisions the Knowles administration sought, and the governor is expected to sign it into law. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Interior loggers currently harvest about 1,200 acres of timber each year. To build the industry, they need more wood. And all parties agree there's room for expansion. The question, though, is how much room and who gets the wood. Governor Knowles offered a bill that lets the state negotiate timber sales in hopes it will stimulate a value-added timber industry. Ron Ricketts of the Fairbanks Industrial Development Corporation says the bill lays the groundwork for a bigger timber business.
The bill would provide a minimum supply, to a company that is looking at the potential for an operation in the interior, and would give them some comfort that the supply might be available so that they can then go to the next steps of their feasibility study or planning process.
Ricketts says the bill's now big enough to fit the needs of an Oregon veneer maker. Alcee Incorporated is nibbling for 15 million board feet of birch it says will support a 45-person plant in Fairbanks. State foresters say there's plenty of wood around to support such a mill, though only about half of it's good enough to make products like veneer. The rest, they say, is destined for a pulp or chip mill. Environmental groups supported the original bill until the legislature expanded the deal to offer longer contracts for larger volumes. Environmentalist Sylvia Ward fears that once a mill comes in, industry will pressure the state to sell trees for pennies apiece until the forest is gone.
When you bring in a large outside logging company, you wipe out the local utilizers of the forest. When you knock those out of the mix, then there's very little to stand between just total pedal to the metal logging activity and the annihilation of our forests.
Ward says where the bill originally fit current operators, it now goes too far, and as state funding disappears, agencies like the Division of Forestry will focus on larger sales, leaving out the small guys. Local loggers have differing opinions about the bill. Alaska Birch Works owner Bob Zackel says if the bill becomes law, he'll take advantage of the opportunity.
I intend to be first in line when after the governor signs this, and according to the state forester, they're going to be willing to let smaller sales be contracted out. So I hope that this is how I get a reliable supply of good quality saw logs.
Zackel admits the doomsday visions are possible, so he says it's up to people like him to stay vigilant.
I generally don't trust the government much on doing anything right, so it's going to have to be watched.
Zackel says there's ample opportunity to keep the state responsive to local loggers, but Four-Star Lumber co-owner Al Peck says his sawmill won't qualify as high value added, and he's concerned he'll be squeezed out. Whatever the effect, retired Cooperative Extension Forester Tony Gasparo says making wood available isn't enough and has to be priced so its refined products can be exported at a profit.
The bill is going to give the industry a quicker chance to come up here and evaluate the potential for putting a plant here. It's not going to guarantee that we're going to get a plant here, not by a long run. There's a lot of other things to consider, like the economics of actually siting a plant and getting the wood out of the woods to the mill at a reasonable cost, and being competitive on the world market.
As wood prices increase, so has the world supply. Chile and New Zealand are now exporting their trees to the Northwest. Gasparo says that makes interior forest more marginal because while there's a lot of wood, there's not a lot of wood on each acre. That means road building and transportation play a larger role here, putting the squeeze on anyone trying to find money in the trees. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
3, 2, 1. It was a balmy 40 degrees at the 7,000-foot base camp yesterday. For folks toting heavy packs up Denali, it's hot and thirsty work. Warm temperatures have softened snow, and South District Ranger J.D. Swed says unseasonable weather makes climbing more difficult and more dangerous.
As the days get warmer, the lower glacier melts out, and the snow bridges that are formed over the crevasses start getting thinner. So there's more of a risk of punching into a crevasse and taking a long fall.
Swed says the opening rifts mean climbers will be maneuvering around crevasses, and plenty are ready to meet the challenge. Over 1,000 have signed up to attempt either Mount Foraker or Denali. So far this season, only 3 climbers, a team from Russia, have made it. But in a few weeks, Swed anticipates at least 600 on Denali alone.
That's a large mountain. 600 people in one place doesn't seem like much, but when you realize that those people, or at least 85% of them, are all on one route, the West Buttress route, and you can almost imagine it being an antline type situation where everybody's moving up or down a particular path.
Last year, Swed says more than 1,200 climbers attempted Denali. Less than half made it. 6 people died trying. Right now, 225 are making their way to the top. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
Former Governor Steve Cooper says boards have a job to do besides regulating resources. They act as political buffers. Cooper concedes no one gets on a board without political action, but he worries about politicians who abuse the system and try to manage those who manage the resources.
The things to remember about a board of fish and game is that it insulates the process of management of fish and wildlife from the legislature and the governor, and essentially from politics. The kind of management which relies on political trends and fads and this sort of thing has proven to be disastrous in states which have tried it.
Cooper says the governor and legislature should consider an appointee's knowledge and experience, not their ideology. And he adds a politically charged process ultimately harms the animals. But political scientist Jerry McBeth says fish and game appointments have always attracted controversy, in part because few agree on the best way to allocate the resources. Commercial, recreational, subsistence users, and conservationists exert pressure on the resource and political arena alike.
The governor, in making his or her appointments to the Board of Game and the Board of Fish, has to keep in mind what the interests of his or her administration happen to be. And then, of course, legislators, when they come to decide whether they're going to confirm or not, think about their interests. And as is currently the case, when the legislature is controlled by Republicans and we have a Democratic governor, then they're likely to be opposing interests with respect to allocation and use of fish and game species.
In a scenario like that, Macbeth says, legislators often wait until the end of session before confirming appointees, trying to wrest concessions from the governor. But this Tuesday, time escaped from lawmakers. Ann Ruggles missed being confirmed on the game board by 48 seconds as the session ended, and legislators never took up Vic Van Bollenberg's appointment. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Three, two, one. Yakutat Mayor Daryl James says the city and borough wants a say in the use of land and other resources in the area. He gives several reasons for moving the boundary to Cape Suckling. It's the western boundary of the Fish and Game Department's Yakutat Salmon District. Yakutat residents hold 1,500 acres in native allotments in the area. They use the area for commercial fishing and subsistence, and the logging camps at Icy Bay are supported out of Yakutat. The municipality's current western boundary is the same as the eastern boundary of the Chugach Regional Education Attendance Area, Chugach Alaska Regional Corporation, and the state's Prince William Sound Model Borough. But James says that boundary is nothing more than an arbitrary line first set for the school district.
The mindset was created with the REA boundary, not geographic boundary, or not historical boundaries of the people in the area.
Yakutat tried to incorporate the area it now wants to annex when it organized as a city and borough. However, the local boundary commission moved Yakutat's proposed boundary east. Yakutat says its annexation attempt is not a tax grab. Mayor James says the city and borough has no plans to tax the logging operations at Icy Bay. But Mark Stahl, the manager of Chugach Alaska Regional Corporation's Lands and Resources Department, says Yakutat's petition shows proposed tax rates and also lists taxable values.
Within the area proposed for annexation, I'm reading this right off their petition, real property, $4,100,000, personal property, $157,500. And then taxable sales of $1.2 million. So they're definitely planning on taxing that area. It says so right in their petition.
Stahl says it would be unfair for 800 people in the single community of Yakutat to get those tax revenues when the 8,000 people in the various communities of Prince William Sound could use that money. Stahl says Prince William Sound residents should be concerned by the annexation attempt.
You know, when the day comes that a borough is formed in Prince William Sound, if there isn't a land base for the borough to use and to generate revenues, there will be higher taxes. And I think people should get excited about this and should write the local boundary commission and oppose this attempt, because it simply is a land grab.
The cities of Cordova, Whittier, and Valdez and the Chugach REAA all oppose the annexation. Cordova says the area is more closely tied to Prince William Sound than to Yakutat. It also says the timing of the Yakutat petition could harm efforts by Prince William Sound communities that are investigating their own borough formation options. But Yakutat's petition to the local boundary commission speaks against reserving the area for a future hypothetical borough. The commission is accepting public comments on the petition through May 17th. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
The military shipped everything from cooking fuel and pesticides to lubricating oils and airplane fuel in 55-gallon drums when it operated the Galena base. Officials estimate that the Air Force lost 100,000 barrels when floodwaters swept through in 1945 and 1965. The military is supposed to clean up after itself when it leaves the site, so nothing was done to reclaim them until the base was downsized in 1993. About 44,000 barrels were picked up the following summer at a cost of $1.3 million. Air Force spokesman Bob Elliard says the military assigns risks to abandoned sites. They are ranked by the level of harm they pose to people and resources.
Obviously, the
ones that have the higher risk assigned to them get the cleanup funds first, and that's the way it went, especially when our funding got drastically cut here a couple of years ago. So a lot of things got put on hold, and that's what happened to the barrel cleanup. Fortunately, we have it programmed for next year, and it'll come back on track in 97.
Since the barrels have been scattered across the tundra by the floodwaters, no one knows exactly where they are. Elliard says the range of the barrel cleanup will be decided by the Restoration Advisory Board, which is made up of community members, although none are members of the local tribal council. Last year, Galena's Village Council received a federal grant from the Administration of Native Americans to study the military's environmental impact. The council has questions about the safety of their subsistence resources and the effects the loss of those resources may have on their culture. Steve Houdeshell investigates the military's environmental cleanup efforts for the Village Council.
Sometimes they overlook certain aspects of the degradation that the community would know more about. So really to get a whole overview of it, you know, it helps to have a community grassroots group that's concerned because they know their community where the Air Force doesn't know it at all.
Houdeshell says the Tribal Council would like to work closely on the barrel cleanup. Since they don't have the experience to get a military contract, they plan to partner with an established environmental firm. The Lawton Village Council has other sites earmarked for cleanup and further study, including a million-gallon fuel spill. In Galena, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Go out in the woods, have fun, just go do your campings, you know, cook your marshmallows, hot dogs, whatever folks like to do, but build a fire in a safe place first, preferably on the riverbank, and put it out before they leave.
Despite the warning, McGrath Department of Natural Resources Fire Management Officer Andy Alexandru says human causes like children playing with matches, brush burning, and campfires have already scorched several areas of South Central and Interior Alaska. Currently, DNR McGrath has deployed 10 16-person crews from its southwest area headquarters to help battle wildfires burning in the Matanuska Valley, Kenai Peninsula, and Kodiak Island areas.
I'm very concerned about locally. We have no suppression forces available in McGrath right now. We do not have our helicopter.
With much of his primary staff also working away from headquarters this week, and conditions in much of the southwestern portion of the state at least as dry as those in South Central, the DNR's Alexandru has reason to be concerned. He's looking forward to next week when the DNR McGrath gets its helicopter back and when some crews should trickle back into the area. Normally, fire season doesn't get underway in earnest in the interior until mid-June when lightning can cause multiple starts. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
The RAIT program allowed the two mothers from Gakona to earn their teaching degrees without having to attend a faraway four-year school. Carol Bemler says she and Sandy McMahon started the program 6 years ago.
We're real proud of ourselves, and we're real thankful to the RAIT program. Just very thankful. It's what we needed. It was like a boost, a shot in the arm.
While Bemler and McMahon earned most of their credits through the community college's Copper Basin campus, their degrees are from the University of Alaska Anchorage. Bemler says if it wasn't for the RAIT program, she wouldn't have gotten a degree, while McMahon says she probably would have.
Because I started out in college right out of a high school with the goal in mind of getting an education degree, but then when I moved to Gakona, it put my plans to a halt. But I think I would have pursued it. But the RAIT program was really nice because it helped. I could start once again. I didn't have to go away. I could start at home and do as much as I could there.
The women could have finished their degrees through Prince William Sound, but instead chose to speed up the process by attending University of Alaska campuses for their last 15 to 30 credits. The college has offered the RAIT program for many years, but its success was limited by supervisory staff turnover and funding threats. College President Jody McDowell says the program exists today partly because of a $100,000 grant from the city of Valdez.
Part of that award was to keep the RAIT program alive because the university quit funding it, so we picked it up. And we had our first two rural Alaska teacher education graduates. These students now are ready. They have bachelor's degrees in education, are ready to go into school system, and they did it right in our campus, on our campuses. So we think that's exciting.
McDowell says there will be more bachelor's degree recipients from the college. The school also has a bachelor's in science and technology program. Still, most of this year's 54 graduates earned the more traditional community college fare, associate degrees, certificates, and general education diplomas. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
Three, two, one. For many years now, American companies have tried to break into Japanese markets with little success. U.S. businesses are now being helped by JETRO, the Japanese External Trade Organization, which is acting as the middleman between U.S. businesses and Japanese consumers. The State Department of Commerce is assisting JETRO in finding businesses who manufacture household goods and unique Alaskan items and are willing to export to Japan. This mission might help many local businesses break into new markets. John Manthai of Custom Woodworking in Fairbanks has recently developed a new line of furniture from black spruce poles.
We look towards moving into the West Coast market, and we've even dreamt of moving into Europe and Asia. This would be a great opportunity. I think that it's an appropriate thing for Department of Commerce to be involved in, because making contacts, especially in Asia, is a difficult process for the small business. And to have Department of Commerce working with public money to facilitate that, I think is a very appropriate use of public money. I'm encouraged by that, and I'd like to be a part of it.
The Department of Commerce and JETRO are also collaborating on other projects, publishing language guides, and helping JETRO find business leaders to attend business seminars in Japan. Richard Flaherty of Apocalypse Design of Fairbanks studied marketing at one of JETRO's programs. General Manager Lisa Penrose says the company has sold $100,000 worth of outdoor clothing in Japan since attending the JETRO program.
It's given us some really wonderful opportunities to explore the Japanese market and put our products in front of the Japanese consumer, and we've had some really great successes, and it just takes a lot of patience, and that was a real good learning experience for Richard to be able to go over there and meet people. From that, we could come back and know better how to deal and how to approach a Japanese market. We've increased our business in Japan, and we continue to expand our business in Japan by attending trade shows. And those were all connections that were started and continue to be fostered by people at JETRO.
Various other businesses in Alaska have also had successful relationships with JETRO, including Judy Gum Designs of Esther and Pat Perlman Designs of Fairbanks. Later this year, JETRO will open its program to manufacturers of building materials, software, and environmental equipment. In Fairbanks, I'm Amanda Russell.
3, 2, 1. Consultant Brian Rogers represents the group that wants to buy the city's telephone, electrical, and water and sewer services. Rogers told Mayor Jim Hayes and council members Wednesday afternoon the deal would make the city more money than it now gets from the utilities, and big electric users would also see substantial savings.
The city currently receives $3.5 million a year from MUS. If the sale goes through, that $3.5 million increases to $6 million a year. And really, on top of that, the ratepayers save an additional $3.5 million. So we're nearly tripling the total pilot, if you want to look at it like that. But in terms of what the city's getting, it's about a 70% increase in the annual revenues that over what it is today.
Rogers says after the city pays off its bond debts and invests the remainder of the money, it should provide a stable and long-lasting source of revenue. Rogers points to the jobs the deal would create. PTI is offering to move its state headquarters here if the deal goes through. The companies will accept all liabilities, including faulty sewer lines that need replacing. Moreover, says Roger, the group will sink $90 million worth of improvements into the aging utilities, something the city hasn't been able to do. That was a point not lost on the chair of the Public Utilities Board, Dave Stevenson, who was in the audience.
I think that it's probably inevitable at this point. The city is pretty much determined they don't want to be in the utility business any longer. Too bad that we couldn't have done it ourselves and stayed in this business and treated it more like a business and reap these same benefits. But the direction we're headed, I think that we have a proposal that's worth looking at, and this may be the best direction for the city at this point.
One sticking point in the proposal is what to do about the city's steam and hot water service called district heat. Since it loses money, no one is certain what to do with it, but the group isn't interested in it or the power plant that provides district heat. Rogers outlined three options, but Councilman Jerry Kleewer sees this as a major sticking point.
The problem is that it's been a system that has not grown, and the reason for that is the cost of converting an establishment to a hot water system or a steam system is rather cost prohibitive to that establishment. It would be cheaper for them just to continue on their boilers or fuel oil or whatever. It's not cost effective to add on to the system, so we'll never have economies of scale.
Despite the thorny question what to do about district heat, Kleeworth likes much of the proposal Rogers outlined. Mayor Hayes says the council as a whole will take up the matter after Memorial Day. If the council does work out a deal with the three companies, the issue could be decided by city voters this fall. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Three, two, one. Pacific Telecom wants the phone company, Golden Valley, the electricity, and Fairbanks Sewer and Water, the water and waste treatment services. The three companies say MUS has fallen behind the times through no fault of its own, but because voters have been unwilling to pay for new plants and technologies. Now they say private enterprise should have a chance. GVEA's Mike Kelly says the three companies' track records should help sell the offer to the people.
I'm hopeful that if we do a good job of presenting it, they will be able to see that this offer truly does have a win-win in it for all the constituencies, the ratepayers, the employees, the city government, the taxpayers. Everybody comes out ahead on this arrangement.
Kelly says although the phone company is still a moneymaker for the city, the buyers see wastewater treatment and the electricity-generating power plant as liabilities. He argues that not selling the utility now will mean MUS will lose value.
And I think that if the powerhouse isn't addressed now, that what we'll see is at the end of the current coal contract, there will be and has been discussion within the city, serious discussion of shutting it down. So I think the city and even the employees have more bargaining power now, and that this is a better time for all concerned.
If the three companies are successful in their offer, PTI promises to move its statewide headquarters to Fairbanks and build a 30,000-square-foot building downtown. The plan and the building design were unveiled yesterday at the Chamber of Commerce luncheon. PTI Vice President Wes Carson said the building, in a downtown that's seen very little construction in recent years, is just a bonus. The city should consider selling MUS for good economic reasons.
Competition is coming in telephone. We're going to see it come on the electric side, too. There are enormous pressures on the sewer and water operation. Private enterprise will give more opportunities. People will face change anyway. This will make it more attractive.
Carson says there'll be no net losses for MUS employees. Wherever the buyers maintain operation, they're promising no layoffs.
There will be others who are in operations that may not be going with any one of those acquirers who we may be looking at some kind of transition assistance to, whether it be retraining or employment elsewhere.
Carson says PTI is also looking at bringing up 100 or more jobs from Anchorage and elsewhere for their new Fairbanks office.
And so even after we go through some voluntary, perhaps downsizing with exit incentives that would be attractive to people, we still believe that within Fairbanks there will be no net loss of jobs. And in fact, there may be some gain.
The buyers bring their plan to the city tonight. They hope to put it before the voters sometime in the next few months. If their effort is successful, GVEA's Mike Kelly said the three companies plan to invest $90 to $100 million in their purchase over the next 5 to 10 years. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes. Three, two, one. The phone company may still have its limitations, but phone lines can do a lot more than carry a call. They can send and receive high-speed data, faxes, internet downloads, audio and video conferencing, even a Hollywood movie. Between new technologies and deregulation, telecommunications customers have access to a lot, depending on where they live. For Alaska, there are some roadblocks. Right now, if Circle calls Central 30 miles away, the signal bounces from Circle to a satellite, down to Fairbanks, up to the satellite, and only then down to Central. Alaska Public Utilities Commission Director Bob Lohr says that's what makes that aggravating echo. And he says it's that kind of delay that devastates data transmission.
Because when you try to transmit data, the other end wants to confirm that it's received the information you're sending and send back a confirmation signal. And if there's a lag time there, everything gets messed up. The data doesn't go through.
Lohr says satellites can be upgraded, and computers can be made smart enough to outwit the delay, but it's expensive, and only one of the costs Alaskan phone companies will run into as they try to stay abreast of a changing industry. Recent telecommunications deregulation will also have mixed blessings in the state. Lohr says Anchorage will do well, with AT&T Alascom, GCI, and Anchorage Telephone Utility all hungry for the city's local and long-distance markets.
That competition, by all accounts, will improve the availability of different packages of service. It will probably drive prices down and give the consumers more choice.
Butler says the opportunity for competition in rural markets is much thinner, and there, deregulation's benefits may be harder to pin down. When he looks back to airline deregulation in the 70s, Lohr sees an example he doesn't much like.
With airline service, some small communities lost their connection to the network, if you will, because carriers found with the increased competition and the lower margins that certain small communities were just not economically viable to serve anymore. And we don't want to see that happen to the telecommunications network.
While loss of phone service is unlikely, it's doubtful the FCC will mandate a full plate of enhanced options. The Alaska Public Utilities Commission is lobbying for it and hoping a federal-state partnership will subsidize sophisticated services. But Boston economist Tim Tardif says that path may not bear fruit.
Another tack that some states and the government and other parts of the government are thinking about are not so much having those services available at the household level, but perhaps available to various organizations or agencies within the community.
In Alaska's smallest communities, Tardif says schools and agencies might end up being centralized connections for the internet or voicemail, fax or video conferencing. People in Alaska's cities with more options will have more things to pay for every month and more companies vying for their business. But Bob Lohr says no matter what, this state won't ever be swamped by the competition.
It's important to remember that we are, after all, a niche market in telecommunications. We're dealing with 500,000 people up here and widely dispersed. That there are some barriers to entry that will remain here even if the regulatory barriers and the legal barriers are removed, that may prevent this being a very attractive market to those that are operating outside.
Still, the market's not unattractive. AT&T purchased Alascom, MCI has a large share in GCI, which has gone into cable, and PTI is interested in buying MUS in Fairbanks. So the market is busier than it was, and the competition may lead to enhanced services for Alaskans. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Three, two, one. Fort Yukon's liquor store has been closed since February after 16-year-old Martin Carroll killed himself. Martin's father, Richard, says his son was drinking at the time. Since then, Richard's been lobbying to close the store for good.
I think the majority of the citizens in Fort Yukon are tired of the destructive nature of alcohol and are willing to give up their right to drink so that others might have a right to a good life without alcohol.
Carroll says he hopes his neighbors will vote to take the city dry. It's a common question before rural voters. Last year, the city of Tanana closed its liquor store after Melvin Edwin murdered sobriety activist Patty Hyslop. Voters rejected a ban, and the liquor store reopened. Carroll says people in Fort Yukon have a chance to make a difference.
We know the evil we have, but we're unwilling to try something new. I think we got to give it a chance.
Cities have been dealing with the problem for years. Clarence Alexander says Fort Yukon leaders chose to open the liquor store in an effort to regulate the flow.
The other thing was that a lot of money was going out of Fort Yukon. A lot of it,
about at least $500,000 a year from that whole area.
Alexander and others argue that by having a city-owned store, it can use the profits for other services. With no store, they say the money leaves town and the profits go to bootleggers, who these days sell wine for $50 a jug.
Ever since it closed, we have, I think the volume of the alcohol that comes into our community is higher than it was the amount that was being bought out of the liquor store.
Alexander says he's lost count of the number of people he knows who have died from alcohol, but a ban won't solve the problem. Developing a stronger economy and giving people hope are the best solutions. Polls are open 8 to 8 Monday. 414 people are registered to vote. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. Three, two, one. Jo Goying estimates it will take her and binder Linda Keenly all summer to put together the 125 books the project demands. Unlike the mass-produced hardbacks most of us pick up at the library or bookstore, the two women must hand-make each volume. They'll sew feathers, beads, and sequins onto pages, hand-paint covers, and bind the leaves together. Goying says, in spirit, her project owes a lot to the illuminated manuscripts of the Middle Ages.
I've been studying illuminated manuscripts like as long as I've been conscious of art because of its interconnection of text and image, but for the purpose of conveying meaningfulness, a sense of the sacred. And that's where I orient my own art, a sense of the sacred. How do I communicate the sacred? And this little book that I've put together, I sense, is an extension of the illuminated manuscript for that reason.
Goying admits modern technology will help her meet her deadline, with laser printers setting her poems and art onto pages before the handwork begins. She has to deliver the books to the museum by February. Goying is known for pursuing the spiritual in her work, says fellow artist and gallery owner David Mollett. He says she's carved out a unique niche for combining vivid colors, everyday objects, and mythic symbols from world cultures.
She synthesizes all those elements in a very personal way that doesn't co-opt or take advantage of those original sources, which is generally a problem for many artists. And she walks a fine line to be able to do this without kind of offending the original source. And I think she's really one of the most successful people at this.
Mollett says Goying manages to explore profound issues without being maudlin. For Goying, the National Museum of Women in the Arts book is a first. While she's always written, this is the first time she'll go public with her poems. And she's excited about being chosen to represent the museum on its 10th anniversary. It's a way to reach her peers across the country, she says, and receive confirmation that her spiritual explorations speak to others. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
3, 2, 1. Mostly Alaska has a lot of water. It pours down in snow and rain. We turn on the tap and it runs out. While some of us haul it, we rarely wonder whether it will be there tomorrow. But a century ago, other parts of the country had plenty of water too, and today they don't. Changing weather patterns, development, and the pressure of population have made water precious. In Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, DNR's water resources chief, Jerry Prokosh, says people have felt the pinch.
It turns out today that if you don't have a water right dated back to the late 1800s, then you may not be getting your water resources any longer.
The Constitution says Alaskans own Alaska's water in common. Anyone who wants to tap into the flow for a well or a mine or other major use needs a permit from DNR. And Prokosh says that permit is more than a piece of paper.
The water right gives you those legal protections you need so that if someone interferes with that use, that you have legal standing to assert against them.
DNR makes sure people do what they say they'll do with water and keeps disputes over rights out of court. The division also keeps records on Alaska's surface and subsurface waters and users. In the past 10 years, division funding has fallen by 75%. Prokosh says computerization and efficiencies have made up for a lot, but this year's $400,000 budget leaves them unable to enforce regulations. This winter, public hearings looked at alternatives, like giving permitting and dispute settlement over to the municipalities or to the courts, or putting more responsibility and cost into the hands of water users themselves. Overall, Prokosh says Alaskans favored variations on the status quo.
Although we understand it within our department that if you do the status quo system and the budget doesn't change or it gets less, you know, we still can't do the job.
This weekend, DNR opens a round of workshops to focus on specific ways the system can work with less money.
And start making the recommendations that we need so we can go forward and look at the regulations and statutes and see where they need to be changed so that we can do what the public thinks is necessary.
Fairbanksons will have the first say, meeting tomorrow from 9 to noon at the DNR office. Meetings follow in Juneau, Anchorage, and Delta Junction over the next few weeks. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
3, 2, 1. MMS proposed a sale of 5.3 million acres in federal waters along the North Gulf Coast near Yakutat and Cape Yakutaga. It estimated oil production in the area at 200 million to 1.4 billion barrels over 20 years. MMS spokeswoman Tina Huffaker says the sale will likely be deferred to the next five-year leasing plan. The draft version of that new plan shows a Gulf of Alaska sale in 2001, and Huffaker says an earlier sale is not likely. The sale is currently scheduled for next summer. As part of that, the service issued a draft environmental impact statement in December. But the agency has since come to believe the oil industry is no longer as interested in developing the area. Huffaker says a final decision on the postponement will come by next Tuesday at the latest. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
We want to start working on building partnerships with both industry and the state. The university has a very pivotal role to play in making sure that our economy is diversified and our environment is protected, and environmental technology is a key to that. And this workshop will start to build those partnerships and help the university define its research goals in such a way that we best serve the state and industry.
Yukon River residents look forward to breakup with mixed feelings. There's always the nervous anticipation about the possibility of a flood, but there's also the excitement of football field-sized sheets of ice crashing downriver at what seems like breakneck speed. That's not happening this year, though, as Larry Rundquist of the National Weather Service explains.
Not following the normal pattern when you think of the progressive ice front that I guess we typically do end up getting. There have been other years that we've gotten this thermal breakup or a mush-out type condition where there's just not enough water in the river, and so it basically sits and the ice rots out in place and then just shifts around, breaks up locally, and causes no big driving breakup front.
Shifting ice sheets persist on the Yukon River above Tanana, with about 45 miles of open river stretching below. The river is open near Ruby, with broken shifted sheets of ice remaining from Ruby to Galena. And it's mostly open water from Galena to Koyukuk, with a small jam at Bishop Mountain. On the lower river from Koyukuk to the Delta, rapid ice decay, shifting, and some open leads have been reported. Early forecasts called for a moderate to high flood potential on the Yukon River due to the thick ice, but the weather has warmed up slowly and the water level is at a near record low. In Galena, I'm Teresa Bacher.
3, 2, 1. Roger Post of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game says lots of progress was made, but not in the direction he'd expected. The meeting aimed to create a plan to manage the lands of the Chena watershed area, which is all the land from the Moose Creek Dam out at Chena Lakes past North Pole, to where the Chena River meets the Tanana near the Fairbanks International Airport. For the most part, though, Post says that was not the subject of discussion.
The major concern seemed to be issues related directly to the Chena River, with the banks of the Chena, the channel, water quality in the Chena River. A lot of people use the Chena recreationally. They fish in it, they boat on it, and so on. So even if they don't live on the river, it's kind of a focal point for the community. You know, it goes right through the middle of town, and it provides recreational opportunities and open space, and so on.
While the meeting didn't address the watershed issue, Post said 14 people did volunteer to form a planning committee to start deciding its future over the summer. Nearly the whole Fairbanks area will be affected by the committee's decision.
We got it kicked off, but we need to have everybody at the table that has an interest, you know, from people that are solely interested in economic development to people that are solely interested in wetland conservation. We kind of need the whole spectrum, and we need, you know, the average citizen in between to represent it so these people can sit down and thrash out these issues, you know, representing the community.
The Watershed Management Planning Committee will have an equal role with the Department of Fish and Game in deciding what will happen in the Lower Chena Watershed. Post is still accepting volunteers. In Fairbanks, I'm Amanda Russell.
Three, two, one. 3 years ago, state officials began to understand the scope of the trouble brewing in village bulk fuel tanks. Percy Frisbee heads up the Division of Energy, and he says back then, officials reviewed aging facilities village by village. But when they pulled back to look at the big picture, they found a host of bush communities with rusting systems that lacked proper foundations, dikes, or piping, and many lacked security fences or violated electric codes.
And that's when we started putting the database together, and as we got into it, you know, it became very apparent that there's a big problem out here. You know, you have tank facilities that were installed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs that are still functioning. What we're looking at is some of those were installed like 25 and 30 years ago.
The fallout of failing fuel systems, says Percy, is contaminated drinking water, children at risk when tank farms stand next to schools, the environmental damage as fuel plumes move through the ecosystem. But as knowledgeable as officials are about the effects, Percy says, the exact size of the problem is still something of a mystery. So the Division of Energy is putting out a call for qualified contractors to go out and survey the fuel farm situation in over 150 villages. Besides helping decide which villages need help first, Frisbee hopes the gathered data will help solve the problem.
What I'm hoping for is by the end of the summer is that I have all that information back in my office and we can add it to the database. And probably the biggest reason I wanted is because I'm trying to go after some federal funds that's going to help, you know, take care of the funding for doing the projects out there.
To do that, Percy says he'll need federal dollars. The estimated price tag for cleaning up and restoring aging fuel farms is roughly $300 million. But before the agency can apply for grants, it needs to have exact data. So it's giving interested contractors until the end of May to apply for the survey work. Percy says more than 50 companies have already asked for applications. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Three, two, one. Paul Skovorek was placed on administrative leave earlier this spring after the State Personnel Board found he'd violated numerous ethics laws. The board found he used his job with the Department of Fish and Game to benefit his private business and recommended he be fined and fired. Skovorek's played a key role in the department's sonar-based fish counting program, and without him, department officials question whether current employees can run its three sonar programs. In a memo to Commercial Fisheries Director Bob Clasby, AYK Regional Supervisor Tom Crone says Skovorek's loss means the department can run only two of its three sonar projects, so he's recommended nixing the project at Pilot Station. But Clasby says Crone didn't fully explain his reasoning, and he's asking for more details.
I had an initial recommendation from the staff that Pilot Station not be operated this year. I've asked the staff to do a more detailed evaluation and provide that to me, essentially looking at all the options, the pros and cons of those options, and then what the region's decision would be based on all that information.
Clasby says he expects a decision by the end of the week. Closing Pilot Station would leave the department without critical information needed to manage the fall chum salmon fishery. With this year's below-average run projection, managers are less likely to allow commercial fishing. And because fall chums spawn way upriver, managers need in-season data lest they needlessly restrict fishing. This latest problem adds to a list of others. In 1993, poor returns forced the department to close subsistence fishing on the Yukon. A year later, the department restricted fishing again when a misaimed sonar undercounted returning fish by 50%. Dan Albrecht, director of the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, says closing Pilot Station will further undermine the department's spotty track record.
95, we kind of got back on our feet. The sonar worked well. We had a large run. We had a commercial fishery again for the first time since 1991. And, you know, kind of feeling like we're back on the upswing, plus the run has rebounded a bit. In order to establish that confidence both for the subsistence fishermen, for the commercial fishermen, and for the markets that buy our fish, we need to have good, solid management.
Albrecht says running the pilot station sonar is a critical part of that management. But if Yukon River management wasn't difficult enough already, fishermen blame much of the trouble on a political battle between Skvorek's friends and enemies. Skvorek's still on leave, but the battle continues, leaving fishermen on the losing end of the game. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.